Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald. Kia ora and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday the 6th of November. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, history, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight we hear about the launch of a new book, Eastbourne, A Postcard Village, from one of its authors. We hear from the audio archives of the Historical Society of Eastbourne with long-term resident Mary Hunt. And there's another Catherine Mansfield short story reading from In a German Pension. Today we'll hear Frau Fischer. So let's start things off with a poem from former Eastbourne-based writer Mary McCallum.
It's got a leaf. It's true, I didn't eat pears for years, unaware that they ripen from the inside out, in spite of a father whose job was marketing apples and pears, who took us on holiday to orchards and packing sheds, all the fruit arriving at our house, tissue cupped and in wooden boxes. Now I buy my pears from the fruit shop in Remu Street, from Tom or Richard or Sandra. I try the winter Nellis, say it Nellies. They're hard and round and feel just picked. Place them on a plate, take them, slice them one at a time to eat. Winter Nellis is the pear Annie painted, choosing a rich red on which to rest its freckled face, deep gold for the skin, the one Tom or Richard or Sandra rushed to her from the shop. Look, it's got a leaf.
And that was Mary McCallum and It's Got a Leaf, with reference to the recently closed Eastbourne Greengrocers. Time for our story reading of the week. Another story in Catherine Mansfield's 1911 book, In a German Pension.
Frau Fischer by Catherine Mansfield. Narrated by Harry Dobby. Frau Fischer was the fortunate possessor of a candle factory somewhere on the banks of the Eger, and once a year she ceased from her labours to make a cure in Dorschausen, arriving with a dress basket neatly covered in a black tarpaulin and a handbag. The latter contained amongst her handkerchiefs eau de cologne, toothpicks, and a certain woollen muffler, very comforting to the Margen, samples of her skill in candle making, to be offered up as tokens of thanksgiving when her holiday time was over. 4 o'clock one July afternoon, she appeared at the pension Müller. I was sitting in the arbour and watched her bustling up the path, followed by a red-bearded porter with her dress basket in his arms and a sunflower between his teeth. The widow and her 5 innocent daughters stood tastefully grouped upon the steps in appropriate attitudes of welcome, and the greetings were so long and loud that I felt a sympathetic glow. "What a journey!" cried the Frau Fischer. "And nothing to eat on the train, nothing solid. I assure you the sides of my stomach are flapping together. I must not spoil my appetite for dinner. Just a cup of coffee in my room, Bertha," turning to the youngest of 5. "How changed! What a bust! Frau Hartmann, I congratulate you." Once again the widow seized Frau Fischer's hands. "Kathy, too, a splendid woman, but a little pale. Perhaps the young man from Nuremberg is here again this year. How you keep them all, I don't know. Each year I come expecting to find you with an empty nest. It's surprising." Frau Hartmann, in an ashamed, apologetic voice. "We are such a happy family since my dear man died." But these marriages, one must have courage, and after all, given time, they will make the happy family bigger. Thank God for that. How many people here just now?
Every room engaged.
Followed a detailed description in the hall, murmured on the stairs, continued in six parts as they entered the large room, windows opening upon the garden, which Frau Fischer occupied each successive year. I was reading The Miracle of Lourdes, which a Catholic priest, fixing a gloomy eye upon my soul, had begged me to digest, but its wonders were completely rooted by Frau Fischer's arrival. Not even the white roses upon the feet of the Virgin could flourish in that atmosphere. It was a simple shepherd child who pastured her flocks upon the barren fields. Voices from the room above. The washstand has, of course, been scrubbed over with soda. Poverty-stricken, her limbs with tattered rags half-covered. Every stick of the furniture has been sunning in the garden for 3 days, and the carpet we made ourselves out of old clothes. There is a piece of that beautiful flannel petticoat you left us last summer. Deaf and dumb was the child. In fact, the population considered her half-idiot. Yes, that is a new picture of the Kaiser. We have moved the thorn-crowned one of Jesus Christ out into the passage. It was not cheerful to sleep with. Dear Frau Fischer, won't you take your coffee out in the garden? That is a very nice idea. But first I must remove my corsets and my boots. Oh, what a relief to wear sandals again. I am needing the cure very badly this year. My nerves, I am a mass of them. During the entire journey, I sat with my handkerchief over my head, even while the guard collected the tickets. Exhausted! She came into the arbour wearing a black and white spotted dressing gown and a calico cap peaked with patent leather, followed by Kathy, carrying the little blue jugs of malt coffee. We were formally introduced. Frau Fischer sat down, produced a perfectly clean pocket handkerchief and polished her cup and saucer, then lifted the lid of the coffee pot and peered in at the contents mournfully. "Malt coffee," she said. "Ah, for the first few days I wonder how I can put up with it. Naturally, absent from home one must expect such discomfort and strange food. But as I used to say to my dear husband, with a clean sheet and a good cup of coffee I can find my happiness anywhere. But now, with nerves like mine, no sacrifice is too terrible for me to make. What complaints are you suffering from? You look exceedingly healthy." I smiled and shrugged my shoulders. "Ah, that is so strange about you English. You do not seem to enjoy discussing the functions of the body. As well speak of a railway train and refuse to mention the engine. How can we hope to understand anybody, knowing nothing of their stomachs? In my husband's most severe illnesses, the poultices." She dipped a piece of sugar in her coffee and watched it dissolve. "Yet a young friend of mine, who travelled to England for the funeral of his brother, told me that women wore bodices in public restaurants. No waiter could help looking into as he handed the soup." "But only German waiters," I said. "English ones look over the top of your head." "There," she cried. "Now you see your dependence on Germany. Not even an efficient waiter can you have by yourselves." "But I prefer them to look over your head." "And that proves you must be ashamed of your bodice." I looked out over the garden full of wallflowers and standard rose trees growing stiffly like German bouquets, feeling I did not care one way or the other. I rather wanted to ask her if the young friend had gone to England in the capacity of waiter to attend the funeral baked meats, but decided it was not worth it. The weather was too hot to be malicious, and who could be uncharitable, victimised by the flapping sensations which Frau Fischer was enduring until 6:30? As a gift from heaven for my forbearance, down the path towards us came the Herr Rat, angelically clad in a white silk suit. He and Frau Fischer were old friends. She drew the folds of her dressing gown together and made room for him on the little green bench. "How cool you are looking," she said. "And if I may make the remark, what a beautiful suit." "Surely I wore it last summer when you were here. I bought the silk from China, smuggled it through the Russian customs by swathing it around my body, and such a quantity. 2 dress lengths for my sister-in-law, 3 suits for myself, a cloak for the housekeeper of my flat in Munich. How I perspired! Every inch of it had to be washed afterwards."
Surely you have had more adventures than any man in Germany. When I think of the time that you spent in Turkey with a drunken guide who was bitten by a mad dog and fell over a precipice into a field of attar of roses, I lament you have not written a book. Time, time. I am getting a few notes together. And now that you are here, we shall renew our quiet little walks after supper, yes? It is necessary and pleasant for a man to find relaxation in the company of women occasionally. Indeed, I realise that. Even here, your life is too strenuous. You are so sought after, so admired. It was just the same with my dear husband. He was a tall, beautiful man, and sometimes in the evening he would come down into the kitchen and say, "Wife, I would like to be stupid. For 2 minutes." Nothing rested him so much then as for me to stroke his head. The her rat's bald pate glistening in the sunlight seemed symbolical of the sad absence of a wife. I began to wonder as to the nature of these quiet little after-supper talks. How could one play Delilah to so shorn a Samson? "Herr Hoffmann from Berlin arrived yesterday," said the her rat. "That young man I refuse to converse with. He told me last year that he had stayed in France in an hotel where they did not have serviettes. What a place it must have been. In Austria, even the cabmen have serviettes. Also, I heard that he discussed free love with Bertha as she was sweeping his room. I am not accustomed to such company. I had suspected him for a long time." "Young blood," answered the Herr Rat genially. "I have had several disputes with him. You've heard them, is it not so?" turning to me. "A great many," I said, smiling. "Doubtless you, too, consider me behind the times. I make no secret of my age. I am 69. But you must have surely observed how impossible it was for him to speak at all when I raised my voice." I replied with the utmost conviction, and, catching Frau Fischer's eye, suddenly realised I had better go back to the house and write some letters. It was dark and cool in my room. A chestnut tree pushed green boughs against the window. I looked down at the horsehair sofa, so openly flouting the idea of curling up as immoral, pulled the red pillow onto the floor and lay down. And barely had I got comfortable when the door opened and Frau Fischer entered. "The Herr Rat had a bathing appointment," she said, shutting the door after her. "May I come in? Pray do not move. You look like a little Persian kitten. Now, tell me something really interesting about your life. When I meet new people, I squeeze them dry like a sponge. To begin with, you are married. I admit the fact. Then, dear child, where is your husband?" "I said he was a sea captain on a long and perilous voyage." "What a position to leave you in, so young and so unprotected." She sat down on the sofa and shook her finger at me playfully. "Admit now that you keep your journey secret from him. For what man would think of allowing a woman with such wealth of hair to go wandering in foreign countries? Now, supposing that you lost your purse at midnight in a snowbound train in North Russia." "But I haven't the least intention," I began. "I don't say that you have. But when you said goodbye to your dear man, I am positive that you had no intention of coming here." "My dear, I am a woman of experience, and I know the world. While he is away, you have a fever in your blood. Your sad heart flies for comfort to these foreign lands. At home you cannot bear the sight of that empty bed. It is like widowhood. Since the death of my dear husband, I have never known an hour's peace." "I like empty beds," I protested sleepily, thumping the pillow. "That cannot be true, because it is not natural. Every wife ought to feel that her place is by her husband's side, sleeping or waking. It is plain to see that the strongest tie of all does not yet bind you. Wait until a little pair of hands stretches across the water. Wait until he comes into harbour and sees you with the child at your breast." I sat up stiffly. "But I consider childbearing the most ignominious of all professions," I said. For a moment there was silence. Then Frau Fischer reached down and caught my hand. "So young, and yet to suffer so cruelly," she murmured. "There is nothing that sours a woman so terribly as to be left alone without a man, especially if she is married. For then it is impossible for her to accept the attention of others. unless she is, unfortunately, a widow. Of course, I know that sea captains are subject to terrible temptations, and they are as inflammable as tenor singers. That is why you must present a bright and energetic appearance and try to make him proud of you when his ship reaches port. This husband that I had created for the benefit of Frau Fischer became in her hands so substantial a figure that I could no longer see myself sitting on a rock with seaweed in my hair, awaiting that phantom ship for which all women love to suppose they hunger. Rather, I saw myself pushing a perambulator up the gangway and counting up the missing buttons on my husband's uniform jacket. Handfuls of babies, that is what you are really in need of, mused Frau Fischer. Then, as the father of a family, he cannot leave you. Think of his delight and excitement when he saw you. The plan seemed to me something of a risk. To appear suddenly with handfuls of strange babies is not generally calculated to raise enthusiasm in the heart of the average British husband. I decided to wreck my virgin conception and send him down somewhere off Cape Horn. Then the dinner gong sounded. Come to my room afterwards, said Frau Fischer. There is still much that I must ask you. She squeezed my hand, but I did not squeeze back.
I'm John MacDonald, and you're in the Hat Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was Frau Fischer by Catherine Mansfield, read by Harry Dobby. Thank you to Bookstream Audiobooks for making that reading available. Next, it's time for a 1993 interview with a long-term Eastbourne resident, Mary Hunt.
Today is 7th of October, 1993. I'm at the residence of Mary Hunt, formerly Mary Chapman Taylor, at 19 Marine Drive, Days Bay. Mary is 92 years of age. Her date of birth is 19th April 1901. She does not look her age. She looks many years younger. She is bright and active and still tends her pretty garden. Mary Hunt commences her recollections of Eastbourne, particularly Days Bay, talking about early homes and batches.
A whole lot of little rooms round, usually, which were used for bedrooms.
Yes.
No bathroom, because yes, they used the sea.
Yes. You are referring to houses in Days Bay,
yes,
Mary. Yes.
And from October, Labour weekend, till just after Easter, all the young bloods and Wellington society boys, or their parents were, they used to rent these batches. Of course, they were just there for their booze-ups and things like that, you know. And they had their sports cars that used to rip up and down the roads, making an awful noise, and their gramophones going all night. And they'd come down to the Sly Grog shop, which was behind the grocer's shop down here.
On the corner?
Just one block of second. Van Helden's is now.
Yes,
that
yes.
The grocer's shop.
Yes.
There used to be there at all hours at night, up and down, and their jolly cars and their gramophones going. I tell you, today's Bay residents were very pleased when Easter came and they went home. And they used to leave those houses in a bit of a mess sometimes. Then there was Mr. Dick. He was Bill Dick. He was the custodian of William's Park.
Aye.
And he was the father of the bay. If anything went wrong, you went to Bill, and he would come and fix it. You didn't have to ring up the plumber or the electrician to come. Bill would know what was wrong, because in those days, we used to get our water from a reservoir up in the bush. And when it rained, the water would get muddy, and grit would be in it, and it would get into your stopcocks and your tanks, you know, and you wouldn't get any water, so you'd ring Bill up, he'd be around and fix it. No money, didn't expect any, and he used to ride a horse all round the bay, and he was examining things, and what else have I got here? Well, the butcher used to come into the pavilion grounds twice a week from the Gear Meat Company, and you ordered your meat. he'd opened up the back of his van and there was some head scales there, you know, weighed the meat out for you. And then you ordered what you wanted the next time he came around. Of course, our graces used to take our orders and bring them up once a week. And you only paid your bill once a month. And there was always a little twist of lollies in the corner of the order box, you know.
Yeah, nice.
That sort of thing. And there were two old maids who used to run the cafeteria, which is now called the Bay, the restaurant down there.
The Cobar, now.
Oh, the Cobar.
Yes, yes.
Well, they used to run this tea room, and no one was allowed in there in bathing togs. But they used to hire bathing togs.
Ooh.
And they had winter curtains and covers for their tables and summer ones. And they would, everything was homemade. And they used to roll their newspapers up tight and go around at night time and gather any wood that had come down in the creeks for their burners and boil the water and have sort of teapot for the water. They made all their cakes. They had in the backyard the path through to the door, both sides was lined with lavender plants. And on Labour weekend, the lavender was always ready to be picked. And I used to help them pick it. And as fast as we could pick it and sell little bunches for threepence over the counter, it would be all sold in one day, because if it was a fine day, the boat would come over and there'd be anything up to about 1,200 people here, you know.
Mm.
Each boat coming over on the weekend would be packed, wouldn't it?
Well, they didn't see the sea, some of them.
No.
I had a cousin came over one Sunday morning and he was on the top deck and never saw the sea. They were packed in like sardines. Then the old couple of fishermen, Italian fishermen, used to live over on the point. Tony Mazzola and his brother. And Tony was a big chappy. And I used to give my husband's old suits to him, you see. And when we'd be going into town, my husband, Phil, we'd say to him, gee, look at Tony, doesn't he look smart this morning? And I wouldn't say anything, because I knew he'd want that suit. Men always want what you give away.
Yeah.
But they never wear it when it's hanging on them. And he used to drive a horse and cart. And if you're walking along the road, he'd say, anybody wanted to fish? And the horse, if you looked round, he'd say, stop. The horse would stop.
Yeah.
Then when wanted the horse to go, you'd just say, go, and the horse would go.
Yeah.
And the Italians used to have some launches anchored in here.
Anchored in the bay?
Before the war. There were a few of them were anchored here, the rest were anchored in Rona Bay.
Yes.
They had about a dozen launches altogether. They had to go to Island Bay when the war started, the launches.
They're really fishing boats.
Yes, yes.
There was one here when we came, 1961.
Oh, yes.
It was just one, but it never went out.
So.
It was nice to see it, though.
Hmm, true.
What did it belong to? Mio or...
Mio.
Or
Delabacca.
Delabacca, yes.
Mm. What's the plumber's name?
Brian Lowndes.
Lowndes. The Lowndes boy's father used to have donkeys on the beach.
I remember
the children to ride, do you remember those?
Yes.
And they used to have a hat on them with some flowers on the donkey's heads. There was a donkey cart and I think two donkeys. I used to feel sorry for those. What are the Brown's boys' names?
Brian and Des.
Brian and Des.
Yes. And these two kids used to have to drag these donkeys along with the children having rides on them on the beach. And then there was the Plunket Ball that used to be held in the old pavilion. And all the verandas used to be tarpaulins, you know, to keep the weather out. And there would be, it was one of the social events of Wellington. anything up to 500 people, would come along to it. And there were about 60 of us on the committee. The supper was all provided by us, homemade, sandwiches and things like that. And so many members had to bring 60 savouries, each member. And they'd all be gone. I don't know what else.
Switch off there.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
4 miles.
You thought nothing of it. Yeah. 4 miles was nothing.
Mm.
In those days you walked everywhere.
Yeah.
And then when we came back to Wellington during the First World War, my father had his business was in Molesworth Street, and they had a flat in his, it was our own building, his building, his studio and workshop was at the back.
The flat above the shop?
Didn't have a shop.
No, it wasn't a shop, just a studio. Yes.
And he had his furniture on display and that sort of thing. And we lived there because my mother was rather delicate and had to be near a doctor. And there were no doctors in there. And the doctor went to Trentham, to the camp, from Upper Hutt.
Yes.
So we had to come into Wellington. And we went to the normal school.
Kelburn Normal School?
No, Thorndon.
Thorndon.
It was Thorndon Normal School before Kelburn Normal School.
Yes.
And they used to, it had a secondary department, and they also trained the teachers there.
Oh, yes. It was training college as well.
Training college. Mm. So you asked me something else.
Mary's father's name was Chapman Taylor. Remember the Chapman Taylor's homes?
Yes.
And furniture and so on?
Yeah.
He was the one.
Chapman Taylor, I know that name well.
Mm. Well known, though.
Yes, I know the name. I'm just trying to think where I've heard it. He made furniture.
He built houses, really, and he did make some furniture for them.
My brother
makes the furniture now.
Moonlight and love songs never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs a man, and man must have his mate. That no one can deny.
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was part one of Mary Hunt's 1993 Historical Society of Eastbourne's interview. Part two plays next Thursday. The Wellington Heritage Festival is still running, and later this month a new history book on Eastbourne is being launched. So, earlier in the week, I caught up with one of its authors.
I hope you'll know that I'm sending a postcard, I don't care who sees what I've said, or if the whole world knows what's in my head.
It's Nick Zangaropoulos, and the book is Eastbourne, a Postcard Village. Well, basically, it's a shortened, my colleague would call it a Reader's Digest sort of version of Eastbourne history. And it's using the portal of postcards to tell the story. So essentially, it's my interest in postcards. And my fascination has always been with Petone, but I live in Eastbourne and I collect Eastbourne postcards. So I thought I'd try my hand at telling the story of Eastbourne via the postcards. But that's where the great thing is that I've collaborated with a genuine historian who is very well versed in Eastbourne history. And so she's told the Eastbourne story extremely well.
So this is Alison Carew, I'm taking.
Yes, Ellie Carew. She's got her full name in the title. It's Alison Carew, but it's Ellie Carew, yeah.
So how did the opportunity of working with Alison Carew come about?
Yeah, so it's quite a cool story. So what happened was, back about 2 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, Mary Fawcett at Schrodinger's in Petone invited Ellie and myself to talk to basically take part in a panel conversation about local history. And being, people that are both enthusiastic about local history and being actively involved in the local historical societies, we keenly took up that offer. And we had a nice conversation at her store with about maybe 20 or 30 people at the bookstore. Very pleasant afternoon on a Sunday from memory. And basically after that, Ellie said to me, hey, would you be interested in doing a little presentation? Because I mentioned to her that I had a few cards on Eastbourne. And I'm also a member of the Eastbourne Historical Society, or Historical Society of Eastbourne, to be precise. And so that was the step two in the process, where I then went along and gave a presentation to the Historical Society of Eastbourne. And from then I thought, well, this is actually the kernels of a book very similar to the one that I'd done before on Petone, but for Eastbourne. And Ellie was very keen on that idea. So that was the genesis, basically. It goes back to the panel discussion back at Schrodinger's 2 or 3 years ago, and then the subsequent presentation to the Historical Society of Eastbourne.
So how did you approach writing the book in partnership with Ellie? How did you split up things?
Well, okay, so this is an interesting story too. So essentially, I had written a book called Petonia Postcard Town, and it basically had, and it was just my own sort of method, my own interest, which was marrying my interest of postcards, which I'm an avid collector of, and my interest in Petone, which I'm a huge enthusiast on. And basically, I wrote that book, and then I thought, well, I can just do the same thing again for Eastbourne. Now, that was before I met Ellie. So I basically smashed something out very quickly, got the postcards, followed the formula, and then I gave it to Ellie and said, can you know quite a lot about this stuff. Do you mind doing a bit of an edit, really? And what happened after that was Ellie came back, and Ellie is very, very good at editing and writing and all of this sort of sphere of activity. And so when she came back with fantastic additional changes and bits and pieces, and I said to her, look, you know, this really, well, first of all, it changed the sort of the nature of the book a bit, but it changed it in an extremely good way. So I said to her, first of all, I really feel a bit uncomfortable about this being Nick Zangaropoulos. Can we collaborate? And Ellie was a bit reluctant, and she sort of agreed eventually to be, Nick Zangaropoulos with Ellie Carew. And then what happened after that? So that was about a year ago, and then we all got busy, and we sort of missed the timeline which we were aiming for, which was the end of last year. And so we said, okay, look, we'll re-look at this in the new year, and it ended up sort of realistically being in the middle of the year. And then we had another few cracks at it. And basically, another iteration down the road, and Ellie did some more work, and I thought, look, Ellie, there's just no way this is going to be, this is a full collaboration. And I persuaded her, and because she had made so many significant improvements. Essentially, she told the story of Eastbourne history so well, and I was really just telling the story of postcards and how they fit in. You know, so it really just became a genuine collaboration. So there's a long and interesting sort of path that we've gone down to, but it's landed in an extremely good place, and both extremely happy.
Yeah, it's a really good mix, as you say, of pictures and of the postcards and the photos, and then the history that goes with them. And from the names of the early settlements and things like that. It's just quite a fascinating read on both fronts, really.
Yeah. We think it's a really good mix because I've quite clearly got a collector's lens on this whole thing. And I'm a sort of a, you know, the hobby's called Deltiology. So it's actually quite nerdy. There's not a lot of us around, but it's, you know, it's photography and it's photographic history, and it's heavily weighted towards pre-First World War. And, you know, for us people that are interested in that stuff, you know, we love it. We're very interested. There is a postcard society, and there's about 120 members, and people are very enthusiastic. And then we marry that with my interest is local history, but Petone, and so I didn't know too much about Eastbourne, whereas Ellie has co-written a book called Eastbourne, A History of the Eastern Bays of Wellington Harbour, and that was a proper, you know, several hundred page detailed history of this part of the world. It was just sort of like a marriage made in heaven in a way. It was a really good mix of the two areas of expertise, and we think it's reasonably well balanced now, representing both sides of those interests.
Now, it's called Eastbourne and Postcard Village.
Yeah.
But your definition of Eastbourne is quite, it's like really the eastern bay. So what's the geographic area that the book covers?
Yeah, I guess when you start moving from Petone, you cross the river and you start going eastward, you start going up Seaview, past Seaview, and you end up in Point Howard. And it's basically from that point on, they're just going all the way around the bays up to Korohewa, you know, the end part where you can't walk any further. That's probably the extent of it, I would say. So, yeah, definitely Eastern Bays. And essentially, I guess the title, and really, I had a thought in my head once upon a time that when I did the Petone Postcard Town, I had this clever thought, well, I thought it was clever, where I would eventually do maybe four of these. And one would be Eastbourne, a postcard village. The next one would be Lower Hutt, a postcard city. And the last one would be Wellington, a postcard capital. And so that's where all of those sort of like monikers came from. So it's not technically, you know, not, it's sort of like a bit of a shorthand.
Oh, a collection in the making.
Yeah. So hopefully, one day, hopefully, because I do collect the Wellington region, and I have got an extensive collection of Hutt Valley postcards, and I've given talks to local clubs like the Hutt Valley, the Lower Hutt Stamp Club, and the Upper Hutt Stamp Club, and places like that, and I've got good collections of those, and I'm very interested. Plus, I'm also a member of those historical societies. So one day, I would definitely like to do one for the Hutt, at a minimum. The Wellington is such a big region. We'll see how we go on that, but maybe we'll do all four at some point.
Have you got a favourite postcard in the book?
Well, my favourite is probably the one. It's probably the one that's on the cover. It's of one of my favourite photographers, David James Audesley, and it's a beautiful capture of the ferry, the wharf, the Edwardian gears that the ladies are sitting on the beach are wearing. Then there's some fishing boats on the side. It really is a brilliant capture of everything going on in pre-World War I Eastbourne at the time, or Days Bay, I guess. So that's probably my favourite, yeah.
Definitely, what are they? The 1903 postcard of Days Bay. It's got such a capture of Mansfield at the bay feeling to it. I mean, you've got the Duchess Ferry in that picture. And it's just amazing that there's so many pictures of the wharf, and most of them have got a ferry boat or two there. So it's very much part of Eastbourne history, the ferries.
Absolutely. And what you've touched on there is actually one of the challenges we have in the book. So one of the challenges was, so what I call the corpus of these cards, the body of these cards, well, when I started, there was about 300 that I was aware of, and I had about 90% of them in my collection, so I had a very good collection. The problem was about 70% of these cards were Days Bay. So you already had a massive orientation towards Days Bay, and then out of that 70%, a very big chunk was what I call the standard view, which is basically looking south, looking over the wharf, capturing a little bit of Williams Park and generally a few. And there were so many of these were just permutations on the theme. It was challenging finding enough postcards to tell the story properly. But we managed to find cards, and there were surprises along the way. Like, for example, I discovered, working with Ellie, and she's actively involved with the Historical Society of Eastbourne, I discovered they actually had a few postcards that I'd never seen themselves. So that was a great start. And then just by complete serendipity and good luck, more postcards emerged during the duration of the writing of the book. And some of them were really nice gems of some of the different parts of the bays that were a bit more difficult to get cards on. We managed to find a good representation in the end to sort of tell the story we wanted to tell.
Another favourite of mine, but it is another Days Bay one, I must admit, was the 1910 postcard. There was a boatload of people on the boating pond, the water chute, you know, behind. And it's such a great in-the-moment image.
Yeah.
And it's actually not that different from what we do today in the Gold Coast of Australia with the water parks. You know, the clothing was different, but actually everything else, things haven't really changed in like 100 plus years.
I'm not sure if it's the same one we're thinking of, but there's a fantastic one where there's all these Edwardian ladies and they're having a great time. They've just come out at the bottom of the water chute and they're very near the camera, and there's about four or five of them in the boat. And but, yeah, it's just a fantastic image of the day, everyone having a great time.
There's so many landmark buildings and sort of businesses that have been captured, you know, in these stories as well. Was there any sort of surprises that you've learned by working with the Alley on this that you weren't aware of before?
Oh, well, not so much surprises, but so much detail. So much detail and interesting stories. You know, all of these places have got stories. Or, you know, where the shops were, where the tennis courts were, where the schools, you know, and who built what. And, you know, here's the fisherman, Russo, who then set up this hotel over here. And all this, I mean, I knew bits and pieces of it from her book, but just getting the sort of the detailed layered history underneath, it's really, really charming.
I like the way you've included some of the words that were written on the back of them, and you've sort of brought that forward when you're looking at the pictures as to what people use them for. So that gives you, you know, a real personal insight as well.
Yeah, I always prefer personally, I always prefer cards that have got writing on the back. Some purists just like the card and the image and prefer a blank back. Not me. I prefer having that social history, and there's often something really, really interesting, you know. One of the interesting things from those days is that those cards were posted often. The mail delivery was often twice a day in the towns. And so some of the cards were used like email messages of today. So you would often find a situation where someone, you'd see a card and they'd say, oh, I'll see you at home for dinner at 5:30. You know, because the card's going to arrive before. You know, it's just crazy to think that. And then there's also some lovely messages about, you know, this will remind you of the time you spent here, you know, very affectionate messages. There's sort of, you know, things about things I've done in the bay, tennis matches or whatever they've seen. Yeah, no, it's lovely to see the messages. It's very, very charming and evocative.
How are you launching it on the 16th of November? What's the plan there, Nick?
Yeah, so essentially I've handed it over to Ali a bit because it's an Eastbourne story, and so we're basically leaning heavily on the Historical Society of Eastbourne. So we're basically combining it with their last formal event of the year. It's in the East Harbour Women's Club Rooms, which is 145 Muratai Road. So it's just across the road, actually just across the road from where I live, handily. But it's a nice central location. And essentially, it's going to be a Historical Society event. They know the place well, and they've done these things before. So we've got a bit of a plan of attack. Essentially, we're going to say a few words each. Terry Lewis, former deputy mayor, is going to formally launch the book. We'll have a little bit of a few refreshments, and then we'll sell a few books at the end of it, sort of thing. That's the plan of attack.
How will people be able to buy a copy going forward beyond the launch?
Yes. So beyond the launch, there are a couple of opportunities. Probably the best sort of stable opportunity will be the old favourite, Schrodinger's and Petone. They will hold the book. There will also be Alfred Memberlink's gallery on the Esplanade of Petone. They will also sell it. There's also going to be a couple of events later. There is an event which is basically the Eastbourne Christmas Market, which is at San Antonio School on the 30th. So that's another specific opportunity. And we'll be selling a few of the books there. Just sort of keep a bit of an eye out. There's probably going to be a promotion here and there as well on top of those things. But basically, probably the most reliable place is Schrodinger's. And because that place doesn't really matter when you turn up, it'll probably be a book there.
What do you think its appeal to readers is?
Well, I think it's a charming little story about a nice place. You know, it's not a big read. I think Ali told me it was like 18,000 words. It's like a long essay, I guess. You know, it's heavily focused on the imagery. It's just a charming little story about a charming place. But, you know, it, realistically, it's probably going to be, its cachet is going to be people that know about Eastbourne and like it. There will be a smaller number of people that are the nerds like me who are into the postcards. There'll be a few people like that that'll get it for its postcard story and merit. Yeah, I think it's really going to appeal to people that have got a reference point to this charming place, Eastbourne.
No, it obviously ties in quite nicely with the Wellington Heritage Festival. What other activities have you been up to, Nick, as part of the Heritage season?
Yeah, Yeah, so today and on Friday, I was involved in taking a couple of tours around Central Petone. I've done that for the last 4 years, and that's a fun little project where we're going around Central Petone, identifying all the historical places, of which there are ample. There's about 25 on my list. It's about a two-hour tour, and I really enjoy doing that. So that's something that we've been involved in. I know that the Historical Society of Eastbourne's also been doing some stuff around newspapers and the threats of community newspapers. That's one of their activities. I know the Historical Society, which I'm the president of, we also had an opening exhibition at the gallery, the Alpha Mumenix Gallery that I just mentioned before. This week coming up, I believe there's a tour of Jackson Street, because I'm also involved with the Jackson Street program. So I've got my fingers in quite a few Petone pies. So there's lots of things happening. I think there's another week to go in the festival. So we try and keep ourselves very involved, and that's a bit of a highlight for us at History Bus.
Now, you sort of touched on it before, but do you have any specific next writing project that's underway?
Yes, I have a very specific one. Next year, I'm going to do a book called Petone Blue Blood, and it is a story about Andy Leslie, the former All Black captain. I'm really looking forward to that. I've done a bit of work on it so far. Apart from Andy being a living legend and a super nice bloke, and Petone, icon, apart from that, there is another personal connection. But a few years ago, my wife and I and a couple of our partners, we ended up buying the building that he used to trade out of. Just recently, we've managed to get on with our plan to develop it. And so I've got this plan, which is I'll try and get the book done around about the time that we're ready to launch the building. And another sub theme out of that is Andy's agreed that we will have one part of that building will be like a little mini exhibition space for himself and Bob Scott, who used to own the building. So that's my next project on the writing front.
Now, if I recall rightly, last time we talked, which was about 3 years ago, you had something on. You had thoughts about doing local Greek fish and chip shops, didn't you? What happened to that idea?
No, that idea is humming along as well. I've done quite a bit of work on that too. I'm probably about 40% of the way through that book. It turns out that when I had the idea, I thought that might be a long burner because I thought I had to do quite a bit of research. And I do, but it's not as daunting as I originally thought. And I've managed to get quite a lot of work done on that. So that's probably going to be the next book but one. So I'll get this book done on Andy Leslie, which will tie with the new building. And then perhaps the year after, perhaps 2027, I'll pivot onto, and as I say, I've done about 40% of it. So, and that's been a hugely rewarding and interesting journey as well, because it's a bit of a different story. But just a quick thing on that. So essentially, what that's about is it's a marriage of the New Zealand icon and institution, which is fish and chips, with the Greek immigration stories. And that's why it's so potent to me, is it's a fantastic story about something that hasn't had much written about it. In New Zealand, despite it being a massive institution, and also that worlds well with the my Greek heritage and the Greek immigration story that goes back actually surprisingly far, not much later than the Treaty of Waitangi actually. So I'm looking forward to getting stuck into that too more in the near future.
What's your take on the health of the local heritage scene? I mean, it's a big festival at the moment. What's the general health of local heritage looking like from your point of view?
Well, it seems like it's not too bad. I mean, we've got I belong to four societies. One or two of them are probably struggling a little bit. But we've all got, like the Eastbourne one is in very good shape. I think the Petone one's in pretty good shape. And we all have our own little strengths. You know, a lot of effort's gone into the Heritage Festival itself. You know, we're trying to keep abreast of the, listing and heritage issues from the wider sort of council perspective. So I think, there's always opportunity for improvement, but I think there is an element of it's not too bad a place compared to one or two other things perhaps. You know, I'm 60 now. The question will be, you know, my children and, you know, the next generation, we've got massive, you know, diversity of stimulus coming, already, and will continue, you know, with the new AI revolution that's about to really, really take place. It'll be interesting to see how this sort of stuff plays out. I mean, one angle might be that there might be a bit of a bump in nostalgia as things become a little bit more weird, shall we say, if AI really takes off, you know, people might end up not having too much, you know, basically all the work's going to be taken away from them. That might be time to actually go and do some historical, investigation and adventure, perhaps. I don't know, just maybe being a bit whimsical there, but who knows? It'll be interesting.
Finally, Nick, your message to Zone Radio listeners on checking out the book Eastbourne, A Postcard Village. What's that message?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you have the opportunity, do come along either to the launch on the 16th at the Harbour Women's Rooms, which is at Muratai Road. That would be, you know, if you've got a chance to get to that, that'd be great. If you do get a chance otherwise to pick up the book, it's going to be $30. It's not too bad. I mean, you can flip through it and see if you like it first, if you go to the Schrodinger's. And, yeah, I can promise you, I think it's going to be a nice little read and an enjoyable little, maybe Christmas present for some people.
And that was Nick Zangaropoulos on his new book, Eastbourne, A Postcard Village, launching 16th of November at the Historical Society of Eastbourne. But that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hut Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a hut story or a piece of music or poetry, then please do message us either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team. And our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Until next Thursday, mate wā and noho oru mai rā. Stay well.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.